Blog Talk Radio.
Right, we're gonna wake up everybody. We need some help, and we can't let the world stay the way that it is. And in order to change it, we can use one of the tools that we have available to us, and that tool is filling in our missing pages of history. Today we have the honor and have a special guest, Mr. Four T. Johnson Jr. He's president of the Cobra Institute. And the theme that he'll be speaking to is the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker. He'll be our special guest speaking to him from the context of that theme. But before we bring in Mr. Johnson, what we'd like to do is welcome all of our underserved communities to MPH Radio. And we'd like to remind you that today the program will entail giving you something to think about as it relates to freedom, MPH Black Mini Facts by Susie, A Message to the Community by Alex Joyner, and then we will entertain our theme today, the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker with Mr. Johnson. So that's the order of the day of this particular program. We welcome you to come and join us at 818-337-0016 and share your views, your opinions, your perspective on missing pages of history, MPH Radio. You listen to the Voice of MPH Radio, and what we're going to do right now is ask you to get out your pen and your pencil and a piece of paper, and we want to give you something to think about as it relates to the concept of freedom. You know, freedom is a concept that millions and millions of people over many, many thousands of years have fought over and still fighting over. And we want to give you something to think about as we talk about the concept of freedom. What is freedom? Well, if you talk to Frederick Douglass, he once defined freedom as, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. That was one of the ways how he articulated freedom. From Frederick Douglass, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Moving on to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., one of the concepts how he determined what freedom is or defined freedom, he did in the context of saying, the time is always right to do what is right. That's right. Dr. King said, the time is always right to do right. What do y'all think about that concept of freedom? Last but not least for today, we will go to A. Philip Randolph, civil rights activist. He's once stated that freedom is never given. It is won. Let me repeat that. Freedom is never given. It is won. It is won. So what do y'all think about those concepts of freedom, and how can y'all apply that to your daily lives? That was a give you a little something to think about segment as we talk about what is freedom. We next will make our transition right now to Susie. Susie is a member of MPH Radio, and she will share with you right now some MPH Black Mini Facts for this week. Susie, welcome to MPH Radio. Welcome, Susie.
Good evening, everyone. Today's Black Mini Facts will come from September the 26th to October the 2nd. The first one is Winnie Mandela, South African freedom fighter, was born in 1936. Next is Harold Revels, first African born in the U.S. to become a senator in the U.S. Senate representing Mississippi, was born in 1827. Guinea voted no to French colonialism in referendum in 1958. David Walker, author of Appeal, was born in 1776. And on the 30th of September, Botswana becomes independent in 1966. October the 1st, Nigeria gains independence in 1960. Also on that date, George Carothers, born in 1939, was awarded a patent for his work on the spectrograph on this day in 1969. And finally, for October the 1st, victory of the Chinese People Revolution, which was in 1949. And last and final for October the 2nd, Ned Turner, African freedom fighter, was born in the 1800s. Also, Guinea Political Independence Day was in 1958. And the last and final one is the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya began in 1952. And all this information comes from the PRSC calendar of 2021, and those were the Black Mini Facts for the week of September 26th to October the 2nd.
Okay, we'd like to thank you, Susan, for your MPH Black Mini Facts. We hope that we learned something, and we didn't learn something, maybe it jogged our memory in reference to understand the value and the power of history, that our people, our communities have been part of the world community. And we continue to make history on a daily basis. We thank you, Susie. So right now, at the Voice of MPH Radio, we're going to take a station break and leave you with some music with a message. And when we come back, we will have Mr. Allen join him, sharing his message to our community. This is MPH Radio.
believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody's searching for heroes. People need someone to look up to. Never found anyone who fulfilled my needs. A lonely place to be. And so I learned to depend on me.
PH Radio. We welcome you back from our Music with a Message segment. And at this particular time, what we're going to do is we're going to make that transition to Alex Joyner as he shares with you a message to the community. Brother Alex, welcome to MPH Radio.
Well, again, hello, Mr. Lee, and also Susie, and our honored guests and speakers today. And I truly thank you, Mr. Lee, for giving me this opportunity to speak our community, because we have so many things going on. And when I say so many things going on, I don't mean just in our community, but now we are an international community. So we have to worry about what's in other countries as well as what's at home. We heard the word terrorists being thrown around all the time, but we find out that we have homegrown terrorists. But among anything that can happen or bequest you now at this time, whether it's the virus, financial trouble, mental problems that you may be facing or whatever, one of the biggest things that we have to stand for is dignity and respect. Those two things are hard to come by. They're not just given away. Some people say you have to earn their respect or earn their dignity before they do anything for you. And so for a long time, I was puzzled with that question of how to make people recognize that I was a man, a black man, an African-American man, or a colored man. But I was a man. And I was somebody, not just my mother and father's child. But I was somebody. So that takes me back to a thought that I thought was very fitting today, and that is colored only. I was born in a segregated hospital in a city that separated the citizens due to the color of their skin. I went to an elementary school that separated the students of the county into schools by race. My church was segregated in a colored neighborhood. The street I lived on had only colored residents. I first learned the names of black, African American, or colored when I asked my teacher why could I not go to the nice school that was well kept and had the big baseball field on the other side of town. He said, they don't allow us to go there. They are white and we are colored. I was puzzled and I didn't understand. What did he mean by colored? I looked at my skin and I was almost the same color as them. Some were even darker than me. After school, my friend asked me to walk across town to his aunt's house with him. As we walked near the so-called white school, he urged me to walk faster. He said, we need to be in a hurry and get out of their sight before any trouble could start. They were only kids, so why was he so afraid? They were students sitting out on the front steps of the building, and they looked neat and well-groomed. They seemed happy and full of joy as we could hear their laughter as we came closer to the school. I noticed how they watched us walk by on the opposite sidewalk, and they seemed to stare and frown. What made the change from being pleasant to being afraid and frightened when we walked by? I didn't know at that time things were going to change. Then I heard a boy yell, why you colored on our street? Get back to y'all side of town. I heard that word colored again. It made me feel mad, and I didn't know why. It was just the way he said it, like I was less than human. It hurt, and I wanted to shout back at him. But my friend said, run before they get you. I thought he was crazy. I wasn't running from something that I hadn't done. I stood there looking at the boy who hollered, and he picked up a stone and he threw it at me. It missed by a mile. I laughed at him, and he turned away and went back to the steps he was sitting on. I reached down and picked up the stone and put it in my pocket. If we came back that way, I was planning on throwing the stone back at him. The first exchange of the word color has followed me my early life, as in the library, the movie theater, the retail stores, the restaurant, the barber shops, all had signs that said white or colored only. Colored always seemed to be second class or to go behind someone that was white. I hated those signs. I wrote stories and marched in protest to denounce the word colored. Finally, our country, my state, and city were forced to withdraw the Jim Crow law that supported separate but equal. It took a lot of brave people who did not run and flee when they knew the laws and the attitudes were wrong about resentment of colored moving into the neighborhoods and going to school together. I sit now in restaurants and stay in hotels that refuse to serve coloreds for hundreds of years. I have gone to school and threatened to close if colored students dare to attend them. Many of the bad things that I saw as a child have not changed, and much more needs to be done in the courts and Congress to change the views of those who still believe in white supremacy and privilege. Our basic rights of voting and discrimination are being challenged and overturned. We are a stone's throw away from considered a second-class, colored-only race. Years ago, I placed that stone thrown at me as a child on my dresser to remind me never to run or flee from a fight that meant I didn't have the right to exist in this world because of the color of my skin. Yes, black, African-American, and even colored, I stand up when my name is called. For the content of my character is not in my skin, it is in my heart. My blood runs the color of all people who are my brothers for life in the struggle for freedom and justice for all. For upon that stone, I built my faith that I could help change the world with words and marching in step to the dreamer who changed the world in the 1960s. The words colored only finally came down at the courthouse, and everywhere it was so proudly displayed to disenfranchise the ones it was intended to hurt. Now we must remove the same hate and ignorance that has been associated with it for centuries. And I thank you very much.
And we'd like to thank you, Mr. Jordan, for your message to the community. And at this point in time, we're going to take a quick station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we will have a special guest today, Mr. 4T Johnson Jr. He will speak to that theme, the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker. This is MPH Radio.
Choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust.
but we shall overcome. I believe someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation, would make a better society.
And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer?
That's right. If you had a choice of color, that's the million-dollar question. Which one would you choose? Welcome back to MPH Radio. We're going to now make our transition to our theme today, which is the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker. Our special guest is Mr. Ford T. Johnson, president of the Cobra Institute. And we are very honored for him to be our special guest today as he come forward to help us to continue to fill in our missing pages of history. First and foremost, we'd like to welcome Mr. Johnson to MPH Radio. And what we're going to do is to ask him to tell his story on who he is. So, Mr. Johnson, we're going to bring you in right now. Welcome to MPH Radio. Excuse me for the interruption. If we had to describe, Mr. Johnson, who are you? What would you say, Mr. Johnson? Who is Mr. Ford T. Johnson, Jr.?
Well, as I heard some of the earlier statements by your guest and some quotes that you gave, one thing struck me, which I think is an interesting bridge to the answer to the question, who I am. When I was in law school, one summer in between, I took a job with an organization called the American Committee on Africa, and I was placed in charge of organizing, running, and expanding a bank boycott against all the banks in New York City that were supporting South Africa and their apartheid policies. And my responsibility was to organize petitions, organize individuals with fairly large accounts to withdraw those accounts from some of the banks involved. And so even at a very early age, I was involved in one protest as a fighter or the other. I'm starting a little bit more in the middle of the story that I will be telling, because a lot of what happened here happened much earlier in my life, before I even made it to law school and finished college from Virginia Union University, after starting college at Morehouse College at age 14. So I've been involved in one way or the other in any number of different fights, but the most significant one that relates to the issue of color and the issue of its impact on our lives is the case that I was involved in while I was a student at Virginia Union University in Richmond, Virginia. And at that time, one day I was taking my family's car with me to somewhere I don't even know, and I was pulled over by a policeman. And as it turned out, and my sister teased me about this quite a number of times, since then, I was driving with my new state tags for the car in my back seat, and I was pulled over and given a ticket, which required me to go down to traffic court sometime later and speak for that and deal with it. And it was during the time when I was going to court that a circumstance arose in which I walked into the court and basically just sat down where I saw a seat. And even when I did that, I could see a variety of different people looking around and the mumbling and whatnot was occurring. And I didn't know at the time and was not aware in any way that I was sitting on what the court had considered and most of the people that were in the court, particularly the black lawyers that were in the court, were looking around, shaking their heads and whispering to each other. As it turned out, I came into the court room to sit down and sat in the first seat that was empty. And as it turned out, that was on the white side of the court, what the court and the lawyers knew and had been set up as the practice as the white side. The black side of the court was pretty well full. Most of the seats were taken, and there was no place to sit. So after all this murmuring went on, pretty soon the court, the judge in the court, spoke to the bailiff and told him, pointing to me, and then everybody looked at me. And I'm sitting there wondering, what is all this about? But the bailiff comes to me and says, you know, you have to move now. And I said, why? He said, because you're sitting on the white side, and you have to move over to the other side, which is the black side of the court. And I thought that was extraordinarily strange, because I had just, within a year or two, gotten involved in a situation where the students at Virginia Union University were involved in a picket and sit-in demonstration against the stores in the city of Richmond. And I had been arrested then and appeared in that same courtroom more than a year or so before that. So I had spent a considerable amount of time in that same courtroom, and it was the first time that a judge had then called me down to the front of the court, standing in front of the judge's bench, where the judge basically said to me, why are you sitting there? And I said, because the seat was empty. And it was the first time. And he looked at me and he said, no, you can't sit there. And the judge himself pointed his finger towards the African-American at the time, part of the court, and said, you have to go over there and sit down. And having just been involved in sit-in demonstrations and being quite aware of what was going on in the country, and that the whole black movement to desegregate and to break down the barriers of equality which stopped us from living, black people at the time, from living totally free, that is to say, to do what we wished to do, provided it was not against a prevailing law. And I was not aware of any law that said that blacks and whites have to be segregated in a court of law. In fact, it struck me, even though I was aware of the practice in public accommodations, in restaurants and in stores and the different things that you could do out in public, it had never occurred to me that a courtroom would be segregated. And so I sat where I wanted to see. But that then became the center of a great deal of activity that surrounded my life over the last, over several years after that, as the case that we brought as a result of a contempt charge that the judge brought against me because I was standing in front of him and refused to go and sit where he directed me to sit. Instead, I moved back from the front of the judge's bench and moved back more towards the rail that separates the audience and those who are coming to face their justice in the courtroom. I moved back to that partition. Usually there's a rail of some sort. And I moved back there, and I just basically said, Your Honor, I don't choose to go there. I would rather stand and wait. And I did so, and as I did so, I folded my arms, not in a state, not in an act, real rebellion against the judge. That was certainly not my intent, and I think that came out in the Supreme Court decision that ultimately resulted in this set of circumstances that I've just outlined. In any event, once that happened, the judge instructed the the policeman in the court, the bailiff, to take him down to the jail cells right now. He is in contempt of court. Now, that did get my attention because I was very well aware of what happened to black people when they went and were taken into the jail cells, particularly if they were acting a term that the courts and the police sometimes used, acting too high. That is to say, acting as if he had rights that the policemen and many and the court system itself were not prepared or had not up at that point granted any of those great rights to black people. And so when I went down, I was a little bit, not scared, but I was concerned. I didn't know what would happen, but of course I had to go down because they arrested me and took me down to the jail cell. But nonetheless, I felt that definitely I had done the right thing to stand in front of the judge and basically said, sir, I would rather stand rather than to go over and sit on what you regard as the black side of the court. And so that's how the circumstances that ultimately resulted in a Supreme Court case and a Supreme Court decision in my favor, thus overturning the decision of the traffic court and the Virginia appellate courts, and became chronicled in a very well-recognized book written by a professor at the University of Virginia by the name of Peter Wallenstein. And the title of the book was Blue Laws and Black Codes, how these practices that had literally appeared to become ingrained as customs in southern courts and in southern states were not the law of any state. They were not certainly the law of the United States federal courts. There had been no law passed nationally. And so the question was, what is it that made that judge believe that he had the right to send me down to jail because I wouldn't go over and sit on the black side of the court? Well, that was the issue that came before the court and resulted in the decision of Johnson versus the state of Virginia. And as it turns out, I later found out, not even recognizing it, as these cases were winding through the court systems, I was, as it turned out, there were two cases that were appearing before the Supreme Court at the time, right after my case, Johnson versus Virginia, came up, another case involving my name, which had the singular name of Randolph versus Virginia, which is the case, the Supreme Court decision that covered most of the sit-in cases, the North Carolina sit-in case, and a whole range of other cases where different black people around the country had been arrested for defying segregation rules. And so the second case actually involved two named plaintiffs, even though there were 34 individuals involved in the sit-in demonstrations in Richmond, Virginia. My sister was one of those. And so both my sister and myself were arrested as a part of the group of 34 that was arrested at Tollheimer's department store and taken down to the jail and arrested and had to appear before the court, the judge, very shortly thereafter. All of us were found guilty of trespassing, and that case was further appealed through the court system and eventually into the Supreme Court. So I think I'm one of the few people that ended up with two cases in front of the Supreme Court at the same time, arguing for the eradication of laws that affected segregation or that were deprivations of my rights under the 14th Amendment, the right to equal protection under the laws or the due process provisions of the Constitution. I had two cases at the same time. The one that I will speak of most here today, because I have a little bit more content and knowledge of what is going on. And the involvement of that case through the Supreme Court and, of course, through the lower courts, and eventually it occurred also at a time when I was just finishing college and had at that time decided to join the Peace Corps during the Kennedy administration and was given the choice of going to Africa, in particular into the country of Ghana, ruled at the president of which at the time was Kwame Nkrumah, an individual who had stood up against colonialism and the tendency of all the colonial nations to place all of the blacks in the countries that they occupied as colonies in positions of inferiority where they didn't have really any rights except those that were determined by their colonial rulers who came from, in the most part, England, but of course there were colonies all over Africa. And so it was quite alarming to me when I arrived there, especially with an individual who was the president of Ghana, in Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, who was actually one of the first people to take on England because of their colonialist policies and his decision to try to bring that country and leave his position as a Commonwealth member and essentially strike out and obtain independence for the country of Ghana, setting a tradition in motion that, of course, impacted black people around the world and certainly had an enormous impact on me, particularly when I remember I was a Peace Corps volunteer at that time, teaching in a small rural village called Dodua, and I was a teacher of math and chemistry in that school. And during the time when my case was winding its way through the courts, in fact, when the decision on my case came down, I was in Africa teaching in this school in Dodua, Ghana, a school called Ganata. And I enjoyed that experience so very, very much. In fact, the entire trip to Africa was one that I was extraordinarily happy to have a chance to do it because I was intrigued by what was going on in Africa and to be able to be there and to be in a country that was being led by Kwame Nkrumah, an individual who had studied his education in America and knew a great deal about the customs and procedures in this country. And so I was right in the middle of so much that happened. And even while I was still in Ghana, a great other individual from the United States was visiting and touring Africa at the time and happened to have spent some time, decided that he too wanted to go to West Africa and meet this man called Kwame Nkrumah, who was the leader really of the African movement to seek independence from the various colonial powers. That man who I had an opportunity to meet, speak with, and meet with was Malcolm X, who was taking his trip through Africa at the time. So we a group of the African Americans who were also a part of the Peace Corps contingent were given the chance to meet with Malcolm X and basically ask him questions, find out more about what he was trying to do. He was on his trip to as a Muslim individual, which was an extraordinary part of his own life and his own spiritual and religious beliefs. But he was very much also involved at the time in a somewhat of a breakaway from the Nation of Islam, and so coming there to Africa and beginning to sort of lock in more with the African independence movement and Kwame Nkrumah, he brought those traditions and that experience back to America with him, and I felt quite fortunate to be able to have a chance to talk to him during those critical years when he was thinking through what he would do, because he was somewhat on the outs with the Nation of Islam, as he could see, as he talked about in the book Malcolm X, that he had seen that there were people around the world who could think beyond simply race and think beyond the concept of holding back the black people and the colored peoples of the world. And so that was what he was expressing to us in the meeting that we had to learn more about his intentions when he returned back to America. And so we followed his story, of course, as he went back and became aware of the division that had occurred between himself and Elijah Muhammad, and eventually that led to his assassination, which struck us very, very personally because we had met this gentleman. We knew who he was, and we felt we had touched and knew a little bit about his heart and what he intended and what he wanted. And so that event also, I think, impacted me very much. And when I went back to the States, after finishing my two-year commitment in Africa, I was very much involved at that point in the aftermath of my case, which had wound its way through the courts, found their way into the history books as a case in which the court basically established that the state has no right to establish or enforce segregation. And so this whole case that was based on the notion of segregation was essentially overruled by the Supreme Court, even though there was no statute that had to be overturned. What effectively amounted to was state action. Whenever a state was involved or is involved to enforce a rule or a law or a custom, regarded the court, in my case, the court that I stood before that held me in contempt of court, it was the practice and custom within the court, because it was a Southern custom of segregation to segregate the races and the people of other colors in the court system. And so my case in the contempt was a case in which the state Supreme Court in Virginia upheld the contempt charge, and so that upholding of the finding of the court that the judge was correct in holding me in contempt. And it is interesting because in the write-up, that if any of you are interested in learning more about this or the whole history really of the court's movement through and the final declaration that segregation itself was anti-constitutional, and a court could not uphold that under any action in which this custom was essentially cited as the rationale for whatever decision had been made. And so it is interesting, and I'd like to read a short paragraph of the argument that was made by the state of Virginia when the case was brought forth and appeared at the Supreme Court, so that you have an understanding of the impact of Johnson versus Virginia, which has been extensive. I was so surprised when in law school I did what's called shepherdizing, and that's when you look up a case and you see all the other cases that have cited it as authority for a particular decision. And by that time, there were cases of all kinds coming from state Supreme Courts, and cases that had also found their way into the United States Supreme Court. The argument that was made at the time by the state of Virginia was very interesting. There are essentially four points they made, and you can get a sense for how weak their arguments were. The first argument was that the 14th Amendment gives citizens no rights. Thus, petitioners, who I was at the time, I was the petitioner and the plaintiff in the case, did not have the right to sit where he wanted to in the court. If he could sit where he wanted to, he could clap or sing or do just about anything he wanted to. And their argument was justice would then go to pot. The court was merely keeping petitioner from doing what he had no right to do. To me, at least, it is obvious that the 14th Amendment gives a person the right not to be discriminated against by the state on the grounds of race. Respondent concedes that the court here was merely upholding an old tradition of segregated courts. And so the whole basis of the holding of contempt was based on a tradition of segregation. And that is the question that really was before the court. And the court, in their decision, the decision that they handed down, which traced things from the old Supreme Court decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, which was a Supreme Court decision made many, many years ago in the 1800s, which held that provided that things were separate but equal, that was consistent with the Constitution. So the Plessy versus Ferguson decision held right up to the point when the Brown versus the Board of Education decision appeared before the court, and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which had established the basis and fundamental of segregation, was struck down. And so the case of Brown versus the Board of Education ruled that separate but equal is inherently unequal, and therefore the segregation of those two situations, supported by the court's earlier decision under Plessy versus Ferguson, should be reversed, and segregation in the courts based on race would no longer be upheld or regarded as equal, as even. So the Brown v. Board of Education was the first decision that struck down the Plessy case, and my case really was the second one of that line of cases that came forward to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in that case, as it turned out today, I had to go take down, I have a framed copy of the Supreme Court's decision. But the court basically was saying was that even though a Supreme Court decision takes the effect or becomes an effect the same as if a law is passed, and it becomes law because a Supreme Court decision often reinterpreting laws of one sort or the other, whether they come from state court or whether they come from the federal government, still have to adhere to the requirements of the Constitution. So the court granted certiorari, which was a granted to take a look at the conviction resting entirely on, or the refusal to comply with, racial segregation and requirements imposed in courtroom. And because it was based on a requirement of a custom, really, of segregation, which the courts were upholding as though it was the law of the within the state, and the law and the rule that took on the effect of law, that it was that issue that forced it to eventually come directly before the Supreme Court, and to enable them, as the court ultimately held, so the state may not constitutionally require segregation of public facilities. And that was the broader ruling of the case, because they were essentially arguing that this practice, this custom, as it were, which had been practiced in the courts, growing out of the traditions that had been established in the South, the court was essentially saying that these customs that you are enforcing through the power of the state cause them to take on a requirement that satisfies all of the provisions of the Constitution. And because this practice denied to the plaintiff, myself, the petitioner, denied me equal protection under the laws, the court struck the case down. And not only that, but even set in motion an order to the state Supreme Court that upheld the contempt citation. Had an additional order where they had to pay money to me for violating my civil rights, and also striking down the practice of court or state enforced actions against citizens that violated the Constitution as the court held that this particular practice of holding me in contempt at the time was unconstitutional on its face, even though the local court and the state Supreme Court basically said that it is obvious that this was a correct decision. And the court essentially said, how can it be obvious unless you construe somehow that your old practice of segregation was itself consistent with the Constitution. And since this was the second in the line of cases following the Brown versus the Board of Education, it was overruled, and the court held specifically that any attempt to enforce as a rule of law within the courthouse or to enforce something that appeared to be, as in this case, there was a state law against trespass that didn't require anything except that the store involved could simply say, we don't want you in here anymore, even though they, by opening their doors and inviting me to spend my money on anything else in the store, I was not allowed to sit down at the counter and eat food if I was hungry for some reason. And that, of course, was a practice throughout Virginia and a practice throughout the South. And so this case of Johnson versus Virginia basically made the court enforcement, you could do what you wanted to do. You could invite people to leave, basically saying to them that our invitation that is extended to you is now revoked. But they really weren't doing it that way. They were threatening to call the police, have us arrested, and by virtue of getting the support of the police, which is the support of the state or a state-enforcement of a customary practice, which was segregation, therefore it required that action be consistent with the Constitution. It was not, and therefore the Supreme Court found the contempt charge that rested on the basis of believing that the store had the right to call the police in to enforce their practice, this old custom of segregation. That made it, of course, right. And, of course, it wasn't right by virtue of the court's overruling of segregation and declaring that this practice of segregation was no longer enforceable within the courts and would not be upheld by the Supreme Court. And so it became a very, very, very important case. I was in Africa at the time the case was handed down, and I remember one day going up into the bush where the children from some of the villages in the mountains in Ghana, near my town of Dodowa, everyone was sort of gathered around, and these people were apparently coming up a path because they were looking for me. There was a group of reporters who had come to Ghana because they learned that I was in the Peace Corps and teaching school in this country, Ghana. They wanted to find where I was because they wanted to interview me wherever I was at the time. So they came up the path guided by some of my students who were from this village. And as they came up the pathway, they were all white, and some of them were from the southern states. And they particularly found this to be an interesting juxtaposition of information and facts. Here's this African-American young man who went back to Africa, is teaching in African schools and helping the people of Africa in whatever ways that I could. And they found that an interesting juxtaposition. And the court had finally overturned segregation. It was seen as a very important case. So as they were walking up the pathway, I kept hearing the people in the village continually saying, "Obroni, Obroni, Obroni," which I didn't know the meaning of that word. And they were alerting everybody in the village, who seemed to be quite nervous and scared at the time, because Obroni meant white man. And because these white men were coming up the pathway, coming into their village, they didn't know what had happened. And I have to admit that I was a little bit concerned myself, because I was the only one that had been from America and learned a new word in that village, Obroni, because there were many Obronis that came even after that who wanted to interview me because of the importance of this case and how it was regarded throughout the United States, and indeed had an impact also in Africa, because Africans had been exposed to this segregation themselves as they went over to America to study in college in particular. And Kwame Nkrumah was, of course, very much aware of this, because he too studied at a black university in America, and was very much aware of the practices of segregation. But to hear of a case in which the Supreme Court had decided that that segregation could not stand up against the provisions of equal protection under the law, and therefore segregation was declared illegal. And so the case had an enormous impact, and it impacted the black community in a very strong way. And as it turns out, Martin Luther King was involved in a court case during the same time that this decision was handed down. It is reported by a number of the newspapers, and also reported in a study that was done about this case by several lawyers who reviewed the facts. And because of the significance of the Johnson versus Virginia case and how it related to Brown versus Board, the second in the line of cases that clearly determined that the old provision, which justified legally and constitutionally, not so much constitutionally, but by virtue of a court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, was effectively overturned and further supported by Johnson versus Virginia. And so that was a case in which I was involved, and which, of course, got me very much seen and perceived by the people in America who read about the case, because it was front page in most of the newspapers around the country, and particularly in the southern newspapers. And one of the other interesting side notes to the case was that at the time that when the decision came down, Martin Luther King and his freedom fighters were involved in a case in which it was being held before a state court at the time. And it is reported that Martin Luther King and his other compatriots who were involved in the demonstrations that resulted in their being arrested, this was from Alabama, when he had been arrested, he wrote a letter from the Alabama courts. And at the time, he was also made aware, very consciously, of the fact by his attorneys that this Johnson versus Virginia case had been handed down, and King didn't have to put up with these practices of segregation, which were pretty much practiced throughout the South. And King himself and his compatriots were being subjected to this segregation, which in this case, it takes a while for a Supreme Court decision to work its way through the court systems, and particularly this one, because it in fact affected the courts and what they could and could not do. They could no longer segregate their courts by virtue of it. But not only were the courts segregated, the restrooms were segregated, the water fountains were segregated, and the place where you go to pay your taxes was segregated. Every facility or capability that involved the things that citizens were involved in, they were segregated if they could be segregated. And certainly that was the case. Another interesting side note, as I read this case and the decisions, it occurred to me, and I'm in the process of contacting some of the lawyers in America right now who are considering, bringing these new cases that are being that the White House has not quite found a way to fight back. Now I'm talking about the voting rights laws that were passed in the House of Representatives have found their way to the Senate, and with the lack of support from two Democrats and the lack of any support from Republicans, the two various amendments that affect voting rights in America and that would be of great benefit to anybody that needs that is interested in voting and wants these various laws that have been passed in Texas and in other states and are now finding their way throughout other states that want to limit the participation of African Americans and people of color, even whatever the country is that they come from, because in America today, all of these people, even foreigners from whatever country, if they're studying in America or whatever, they are construed and they construe and see themselves also as being as falling under the same constricted rules and regulations that are broadly classified and considered to be forms of segregation. The court affects them and is intended to expand their rights in the same way that it was intended and has indeed pretty much knocked down discrimination, even though there are some areas of the United States where these practices are still carried out. But what is more tenuous is the fact that new laws are being passed which don't overtly seek to discriminate against African Americans and other people of colors from around the world. But one of the interesting questions is the question that I am raising and will be in the process of discussing with various lawyers is whether or not the basic holding in the Johnson versus Virginia case, which because in this in the case of the new laws that are being passed, it's not because of an overt designation that of specifically focusing on a particular class of people, but what it does do is it affects a certain class or group of people who are most seriously affected by these new laws. Not to mention that, and the argument from the states that have passed these restrictive voting laws that restrict the numbers of people, particularly people that are affected by such things as the hours in which they can come down, eliminating voting Sundays where participants or individuals, particularly in black churches, although it affects everybody, it disproportionately affects and is a hindrance to people of color in whom these new laws being passed throughout the country affect people of color to far and disproportionately to other people, to white people, even though it affects them as well, even though it is doubtful whether or not the police would attempt to enforce these laws against white people as they likely would against people of color. But the question that I am raising and will be raising with a number of attorneys is whether or not the logic that was used in the court in the rulings on Plessy, not so much Plessy versus Ferguson, but in Johnson versus Virginia, could be utilized in a way to expand the logic of the court in the Johnson v. Virginia case to talk about, even though the court in Johnson versus Virginia, the contempt court, specifically called me down to the front of the court because apparently I was the only person of color sitting on what was perceived by custom to be the white part of the courtroom. It seems to me that logic could be stretched not very far to talk in terms of especially a new set of laws that we believe would be enforced by the police if called upon to do so, and could even be enforced directly by the police if they felt that there were people that were attempting to go against these new laws that have been passed in states like Texas, and they are being passed more and more. But the question is, Can the decisions, clearly Johnson versus Virginia was one of the second major cases in the line of Plessy versus Ferguson, which overruled separate but equal. The new laws that are being passed do not have an equal effect and therefore cannot find protection under the Constitution. And it seems to me there is some room for that argument being made as part of the grounds to argue that these cases should be declared as unconstitutional in the same way that the custom of segregation in courts were found to be unconstitutional in the Johnson versus Virginia case. And so there are major implications, not only at the time this was passed, but even at the time when the case was going through the courts and even today. But I haven't seen the arguments from some of the people that are arguing and will be bringing court cases against the state of Virginia and other states that are passing these highly personalized to people of color because they are primarily impacted by the nature of these laws. And if they are disproportionately affected, it seems to me that therein lies the potential grounds for challenging these laws under a very reasonable, it seems to me, and logical extension of the logic of the Johnson versus Virginia case. But they are not; these laws are not overtly and clearly saying any people of color, you can't do this and you can't do that, which obviously, but it is really more subtle. But one could very easily argue under the extension of the Johnson versus Virginia logic is that, and in some cases it's worse because here it's quite clear that the intent of the legislatures in these states is to specifically disproportionately impact people of color who are affected by the restriction in the number of hours for voting or restricted in not being able to receive ballots from which they could vote and mail it in. The mail-in thing would be affected disproportionately by people of color. And just as in the Brown versus Board of Education case, the principal evidence that was brought by the attorneys like Oliver Hill and some of the other great civil rights lawyers that participated in the Brown versus the Board of Education case, they were arguing, really looking at statistics, that the evidence exactly supported that the intent of Brown v. Board that made it not separate but equal could easily be determined by looking at the results of what had happened over a number of years when the reversal of the Plessy v. Ferguson and the implementation of separate but equal was the custom throughout the South. And so I think, and even to argue that in this case it should even more definitely be declared unconstitutional because there was an intentional in the courts, there's a concept called mens rea, and it means guilty mind. And it means if someone really intends to do something, they had a guilty mind at the beginning, and therefore their treatment under the law should be more harsh than an individual who either accidentally does it or finds themselves in an untenable position, but not with their intent to violate a set of laws. In this case, it was not the people who want to vote in the state of Texas who are trying to break the law. It was legislators in the state of Texas and in other states who themselves are trying to create effect by virtue of putting into effect laws that statistically, in the same as was happening in Brown v. Board, affect certain populations and groups of people disproportionately than other groups of people. And the state legislatures who are passing these laws know that they will affect black people and people of color disproportionate to the white people who would be affected by these these voting rules that are designed to hold back the vote of people of color. So that is a question that right now I am raising, and I think I'll be contacting a group of lawyers to see what they believe is the tenable nature of this, and perhaps get them to begin to write articles or make this case more in the public arena as these cases go forward. But that is an even current and more relevant impact potentially of Johnson versus Virginia, because I think that the decision in Johnson versus Virginia is even more germane to looking at these voting rights laws that were passed with the intention on the part of these state legislatures to impact people of color disproportionately, and precisely because of their intent to discriminate and to affect the voting impact of a particular group or class of people, that they should be viewed even more harshly than for any other reason. The state legislatures are intentionally doing this. And so that simply is at least some of the thinking that I have been doing as I have even been had the chance to review the decision of a court, which I, as I indicated, pulled out my copy of the case itself and looked at the more sweeping language that is contained in the Johnson versus Virginia case. For example, it says a state may not constitutionally require segregation of public facilities. Now, the question is, even though that speaks directly to discrimination and segregation in a public facility, the understanding of the state's interaction has to do with action taken by or supported by the state or the administration of the state by police, courts, or any others who enforce the laws of the land or the laws of a state. So it seems to me that there is a tenable case here, basing it on Johnson versus Virginia, for bringing court actions that challenge all these laws, and by virtue of it, it would require a ruling that intentional, proportionately passing laws designed, again, by intent to disproportionately affect one group over another group, that in itself would be a grounds for proving that there is unequal protection under the law, under that state's laws, if they reflect that same objective. Now, I don't know the overall effect of it, but it seems to me that it is a viable argument, and I'll be continuing to pursue this, contacting some of the lead lawyers and seeing what they think about this as a grounds of challenging what is happening in some of the states. So in any event, that is one of the major cases that I was involved in, and my experience as a, quote, freedom fighter, I guess you could say, I'm still fighting, and I assume we all will, until these things, these new set of laws and new set of rules that states are trying to put in place for one very simple reason, is that without these things in place, a group of people identified more with the Republican Party are questioning whether they'll be able to win any of the great and major presidential and senatorial and House elections. And so this is a challenge that is being made or is being talked about, and one hears about it on the news quite frequently. And I hope that even those of you who get on the radio and have a chance to call in to different stations or write in questions, that you can also send out these very, very same issues and bring the issue up before other news stations and other broadcasters who might be willing to come forward and raise these questions, because I think these questions that I am raising today have to find their way into the attention and consciousness of the public at large, and therefore they will carry greater weight as they come forth at various state levels where these laws can be challenged, even in state courts, and certainly they, I believe, could be challenged at the Supreme Court, even though one looks at the right drift of the Supreme Court today in a number of their decisions. But nonetheless, these are lawyers. They do have the ability to look objectively at cases, just as they did in the Johnson versus Virginia case, and in the Brown v. Board case, and in a whole range of other cases. They are able to look at it. And my own legal training, because a lot of these things took place while I was in law school, getting involved in various activities, one more of which I guess also justifies, I think, my treatment in the freedom fighter category. When I was in law school, in addition to one summer running the anti-apartheid demonstrations in that city against banks that were supporting apartheid, and getting people to withdraw their accounts from these banks, which did have an effect on the people, and it had an effect on South Africa, because their whole survival was based upon the fact that banks overlooked this whole question of apartheid and nonetheless brought their business to American banks, particularly the large ones like the Bank of America and the various other very large banks in New York City, where I was at the time. And I was working with a Philip Randolph at the time. The name was mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast, for in a very strange way. I worked directly with A. Philip Randolph and a group called the Committee on Africa, which was against apartheid and was set up for the very purpose of trying to put pressure on South Africa to reverse apartheid, which eventually did occur. But A. Philip Randolph was affiliated with the Committee on Africa. And I, for some strange reason, after meeting him and getting to know him, and because the Committee on Africa, which I believe he was the chairman of that committee, and hundreds of letters had to go out under his signature, he gave me the authority to sign his signature on all the letters that went out under his name. So I had to establish some sense of confidence with him so that he would give me or grant me that authority. So I was working with him and working with the American Committee on Africa during one of my summers, and got involved in that aspect of the civil rights movement. And one of the other summers, law school was 3 years, and one summer also, this was after the public accommodations law had been passed at the United States courts at the national level. I was working for the United States Commerce Department, and they had a group in the Commerce Department, which was involved in seeing to it that these new laws that affected businesses and affected commerce were being implemented properly. And I came up with the interesting idea, why don't I go down to Mississippi and test whether or not the public accommodations, restaurants, and different sit-in places in stores throughout Mississippi were in fact following the law. Now, where that idea came from, because it was a dangerous journey that I was taking down to Mississippi, renting a car and involving a whole group of other citizens from both black and white to go with me into these restaurants and other places and sit down, do a sit-in, and see whether or not we would get served, particularly an interracial group. And so that was one of the civil rights things I got involved in during one of my summers, during the period, interim period of the various years in law school. Well, we actually were able to sit in a great number of these restaurants, even though everyone was talking and gossiping when they would see an interracial group walk into the restaurant and sit down, taking seats, getting along just fine. But it was another actual demonstration. The only problem with my whole involvement in that program is that I came back from the summer activity of testing restaurants in Mississippi, having gained 10 pounds. And it turns out that we were actually quite successful in demonstrating that there was reasonable compliance with these, with the new public accommodation laws. And the name of that group in the Commerce Department was the Community Relations Service that I worked with for that one summer that I did my great testing of restaurants. I had come down to Mississippi right after the murdering of Medgar Evers, which some of you may remember that from the early news of those earlier years, when there was a great deal of killing of people coming down to the South to desegregate and go against their customary fashion of living, which, of course, included to a great degree the segregation of everything, although there were some that earlier on their own began to show their willingness to comply. It was a very tepid time. I remember driving back from a city in Mississippi and driving back to where I caught the airport to leave the state, and being followed by these pickup trucks that were speeding as I was increasing my speed. And it was a little frightening because one of them passed me, and I could see all the guns in the cabin portion of the pickup trucks that they were driving. But nonetheless, I was able to make it back, file my report, and continue with law school. But these are some of my experiences dealing with this whole issue and some of my hopes as we go forward in hope and seeing and exploring on my own and potentially writing up some articles talking about the application of the Johnson versus Virginia holding that the court reached in that case that might have applicability to challenging state courts, and eventually, if they are to uphold those laws, which they very likely will, taking the cases to the Supreme Court and thus seeing if we can't get a Supreme Court ruling that would do it. The potential of getting the Senate to pass those two bills that came out of the House that dealt with voting rights, it does not look at this moment as if they are going to pass or that the Democrats are going to develop enough willingness on the part of everybody in the Democratic Party to challenge the laws that make it difficult for them to even get these new laws passed by the House in front of the Senate, even for a vote, is really the question. So that's pretty much what I would have to say about the civil rights movement and the case, my involvement at a number of different levels, both with the American Committee on Africa and the involvement with the agency within the Commerce Department, which supported me in my desire to go down south and test that law and file a report or place more attention on challenging some of the state courts in the South, particularly starting in Mississippi, to see what was needed to challenge places or restaurants or other public accommodations if they did not feel that they were willing to follow the new law, the public accommodations law, but were instead more willing to follow the old customs of the South, which clearly involved, and indeed they did not require, a segregation as part of their practices. And so that's that story. Now there's another whole part of this issue which goes to other issues. I don't know if I will have the time to do that. And Lee, I want to ask you how much more time we have in order to go into the seeker part, because I think that is a very interesting, fascinating, and it's in my life right now the center of my own activities in trying to broaden the states of consciousness of people and getting them to understand more about who indeed they are and what powers they already have if they have the courage to begin to utilize those powers.
Okay.
Lee, if you can hear me, where am I on time?
We have time. We have at least another hour. We can allow you to articulate your experiences and understanding. But what I want to do right now, I want to ask you one question. We're going to the station break. Then we'll come back. We would like to let some of our listeners to chime in on any questions or comments they may have for you up to what you have discussed so far.
That,
so what I want to do right
good.
Now. Okay.
That's
what I want
fine.
To do.
Right
what
ahead.
I want to do right now. What I want to do right now, ask you this particular question. Then we're going to a quick break. Then when we come back, we'll open up our phone calls. Mr. Johnson. Many people argue today that looking at, and I want your legal mind, your real bright legal mind from your perspective, looking at the history and the way laws and the Constitution were developed, many people argue that we are never actually became citizens of this country. And one of the issues that comes from this argument is the issue of we are citizens. Why is it that every 20 years we have to get a Civil Rights Act passed by Congress to allow us to vote? Why is that particular history and condition is only placed on African people who were born in this country? What would be your response to that?
Well, I would say that it starts from an understanding that I think we all have that was a basis really for the Supreme Court's decision in my case, and that is that the custom and belief and the whole issue of white supremacy has been an ingrained teaching in the minds of white people throughout this country, and the issue that people call, I think, or notify as white privilege. White supremacy is a belief and fundamental way of thinking in which they believe that, and this has been pointed out again also in some of the decisions of the court and certainly of the petitioners, the ones who submitted my case to the Supreme Court. My father was an early leader with the NAACP. And this is in a small country town called Lawrenceville, Virginia. He was the leader of that. So I grew up with these kind of ideas of challenging and fighting this whole issue, the mental construct within the minds of many, many, many people, and this whole issue of white supremacy or white that whites. One thing about people, even poor whites, the one thing that they don't like to believe is that they are at the bottom of the stack. The whole issue of white privilege and is really based upon this whole notion of keeping people down, thus in order to make you feel that you are in a better and a superior position. And this is a very, very much, having grown up in the South myself, I can tell you for a fact that this is really one of the fundamental beliefs that exists in the South and certainly has permeated many throughout the country, because segregation was not just something practiced in the South, and the effects of segregation were felt throughout this country. There are parts of this country that were very segregated, so it was not just a Southern phenomenon. So whenever this is seen and felt, even in Africa, I could see how whites who were part of the parent countries that had set themselves up as, quite frankly, rulers of those countries. The blacks in those countries had to deal with the same kind of feeling of white supremacy and white privilege, in that everything in the country was run by white people, as has been true in almost every state and even in the majority of states. But blacks slowly but surely are challenging these things, and as they do, there is a growing feeling that that is the way it should be. Certainly the Supreme Court decisions have helped, and certainly the demonstrations that have occurred. But when people start out with a feeling of privilege, they don't want to give that up because it places someone even above them. And this has been the position of many in many states and countries. And so that is why when people are attempting to establish equality, and are, they've also got to help the people who are caught up with a kind of a mental problem. And they, it is, I've always known, as I came up with my father and participated in the, with the NAACP, I would hear many of these same topics discussed, and people would ask the same question: why do we have to keep finding ourselves in those positions? It's because whites don't want to give up their privileged positions and their inner belief that they are superior. And these same feelings were the basis for the protests that occurred in Africa as they tried to establish their independence. Certainly Kwame Nkrumah ran into this in Ghana. I personally saw this, and it was something that affected all the other African countries. Even though the blacks were in the majority, they had to overcome decades of white rule in those countries. And so they had the same feelings of inferiority that some possessed, but it took them time. People like Nkrumah, and certainly the many who came to America and saw the progress that blacks were making in establishing their notion of equality. And so it's something that takes time for people to accept the real truth. And it takes a legal system that is prepared to see it for what it is. America has many, many great principles. And as one who had the good fortune of studying constitutional law and the other aspects of American, the foundations of the American legal system, I still have a considerable amount of confidence in the fact, in the American legal system. I think it has the foundations for doing it, but it still has to deal through the belief structures that are in bed in the minds and hearts of many, many people who feel that there is a concept of superiority, and because they have been in control for so many years, not to mention the whole history of what black people from slavery on, and the opposition even today from white people who don't want any of these true stories being taught to their children, and they don't want to, they don't want to see it because they don't want some of this inbred, some of these inbred teachings which are still being fostered on new generations of white children. They don't want them to be taught these things that make the America and America's legal system not seen in the right light. But as we know, it from time to time, you also hear a very excellent group of counter ads that go on. I've seen more of them on MSNBC, but the whole issue is we understand he's challenging it directly. They call him the Rev. I forget his full name, but he puts these ads on, which talk about the history from slavery on through the period when there were indeed blacks who took positions in as senators in the United States, and it has been a slow, gradual process because we've been working through all of these wrong and even psychologically debilitating ideas that have been fostered through all the period of slavery, predominance, and segregation in the South, and colonial rule in Africa. All of our people have been subjected to some of the same sets of debilitating psychological attitudes that, quite frankly, white people have to overcome, and they are gradually overcoming it, but it will take more time, and there must be a constant flow of challenges made that will be required before they wake up to the realization that, well, I guess it's true. There is equality, and these people deserve the right to live under these laws. I think the common denominator are the laws in the United States, and these are, that's why the passage of these, the new voting rights, because that is the principal issue. When you get the vote and you're able to foster it. So the election of Obama was certainly not enough to do it. It was an interesting starting point, but it is certainly not the end of it. The battle and the struggle will go on for some time because the whites have psychological issues and problems retaining their own sense of privilege and their own belief structures that they want to maintain, which is why the white community is fighting so very much this whole drive to teach the true history of America and what happened and what the people who were ruling America at that time, what they have done to cause these problems, and therefore it has to take something that also requires the deep involvement of white people to recognize openly that they got it wrong and that it is essential in order for America to realize its true potential, which I believe they want to do, but they have to see the truth. The truth has to come out. And as that comes out faster and faster by the actions of all of us, whether through demonstrations, picketing, or finding ways of getting these ideas out in front of the public, that is what it will take in order for us to not have to fight this every 2 minutes because someone else who hasn't overcome their psychological problem that has grown out of the history that they have been taught and the history that they have known, which supports segregation and supports this whole concept and attitude of privilege, which has infected large numbers of the white population. That has to be overcome, and we have to literally tell the truth and make sure that our school systems teach the truth about this in history classes and things, and this can be done at the local level, and it can be done at the national level. And more people are seeing that it's this fight that's being done at the local levels where we are able to get the white children of the populations that have supported and maintained segregation, get them to teach these children a little bit about the truth, the freedom fighters that have existed for many, many, many years. And, of course, we have a very gallant and impressive history of black people who have fought for these rights and fought to bring this attention and help with the cleansing of the minds of white people. And if we can bring this up now before another population of children and people to get to know what the real truth of the story behind America is, whether it requires it taking from slavery through discrimination, through segregation, through all of these different stages into some of the more redeeming periods in America's history. I think the whole story needs to come out more. But if you're only going to start with the few successes that America had with Brown v. Board and even Johnson versus Virginia, which has not nearly, I think, paid its full price. In fact, I found out that the state of Virginia still owes me $100 because the Supreme Court sent down an order to the state Supreme Court ordering them to pay me $100 for my court costs in having to bring this case. They haven't paid me my $100 yet. And in fact, until I read some of the details of the book that I mentioned earlier, Blue Laws and Black Codes, Wallerstein had pointed out that one of the orders issued by the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court decision was handed down was that the court was to pay me $100 for my court cost and the cost of filing it. I've never gotten that, but I expect and intend to raise that issue again and see if I can't get a group of lawyers behind it to see what at least publicity we can make upon it, because in every way that we can think about, we've got to bring the truth to the minds of people, because we see what happens when the untruth is taught or continually supported in the minds of the public. It makes it even more difficult. We have a lot of untruth floating around, and every opportunity at state and local levels with school boards, and even getting my $100 back and raising something of a stink about it. Those are ways in which these stories, as they keep being told, let people know that the old days are over and the new day is here. People are entitled to equality under the law, and the Constitution means what it says, not what people will lie about the Constitution and say what it means. So those are just a few reflections that I have about it. But it's, in many ways, it depends upon, like most things, it depends upon what we do about it and the intensity with which we are prepared to take this issue at local levels with school boards, when they vote on the books that should be used. All of these things will get it into the minds of other people. So we have something to do with this also. We can't just sit around and wait and expect it to happen on its own. It will not happen, as was quoted in some of the quotes that that Lee, you read out at the beginning of our broadcast. You might want to repeat a few of those, because it really is going to turn on us. It's what we do and how we push and how we raise these issues that first frees people from the lies that they have been taught and that they still believe, which causes them to act in ways that are contrary to the Constitution. We do have a beautiful document that sets forth the kind of goals and standards which, if we were to reach, we would in fact make this country what it was always intended to be. But because some people have false beliefs about what the Constitution stands for, especially when they don't want to tell the truth to the children and teach them from the beginning what the truth was about this country and what some of their parents and elderly ones, what they did to hold this country back. That is when this truth begins to be known by all, that all people will begin to understand that we must do this in order to bring it to the beginning. The Biden administration is fighting the same battle, because he's fighting a lie that has sent itself around so long until he can't get people to even find room in many cases for what the truth is. So I would say it's all part of that same story, but teaching the truth to the people of America and the history of the true and the real America and what has to be changed in this country, that, I believe, is what's going to make the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that response. Right now, this is the voice of MPH Radio. We are discussing that theme today, the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker, with Mr. Ford T. Johnson, Jr. We're going to a station break, and when we come back, we will continue the discussion. This is MPH Radio.
Control the sound of soul, shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to soon. politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Welcome back to MPH Radio. This world is a ball of confusion. And with us today, our special guest, Mr. Ford T. Johnson Jr. He's going to help us to address this issue of confusion so we can see some clarity. He is doing this by telling his story and his experiences as being a freedom fighter, a traveler, and a seeker. Right now, we're going to open up our phone lines. If you have any comments or questions you'd like to ask Mr. Johnson, please dial in 818-337-0016. Hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers. Mr. Johnson, right now, we're going to our phone lines. We have some people who like to make a who has a question or a comment. We'll go to Susie. Welcome to again back to MPH Radio. Your question or comment for Mr. Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Johnson, I'd like to ask you, do you think black HBCUs are relevant today, being that you graduated from one?
Well, let's put it this way. I think, first of all, for people that must learn a whole host of things before they can function properly and effectively in this new society and this new economy, I think that to obtain an education is very, very vital. But I think that the emphasis on the black colleges, it depends upon what they're standing for and what the intent is. I started going to the school I finished was not quite like the school that I started from. I was fortunate enough to receive an early entrance scholarship to Morehouse College. And started college at age 14. And I felt very blessed to do it because it grew up in an atmosphere in which many of the people that became the civil rights leaders of later years went to Morehouse and had the benefit of the great instruction of the president that everyone called Buck Benny. And Morehouse is a college that, along with Fisk at the time when I was there, I benefited greatly from it. I think that it didn't focus as much on the kinds of things that I later learned and that I learned even while I was with my father, who was the head of the NAACP and had to take many risks himself to put himself in that position in a very small country town called Lawrenceville, Virginia, where another black college existed, St. Paul's College, at which my mother taught. So I think that there is still relevance to them. but I don't think that they are as essential as they used to be, because any individual who has set a very good foundation for themselves in the grades that they've obtained at, you know, high school and then moved on to college, and but mostly at the high school level, they can pretty much get in any school in the country. I studied both at Morehouse, and then I went to the University of California at Berkeley, where I did my study in order to become a Peace Corps volunteer and travel to Africa and learn something about that continent. And then later, while I was still in Africa, having served my 2 years in the Peace Corps, I was admitted to Harvard Law School, which is, I think, still one of the greatest law schools in the country, and where I developed a stronger foundation about law, and then decided not to practice law, because actually I had what came to be in my life an even higher calling. I became a spiritual seeker, and I knew that there were fundamental truths in the universe that school, books, newspapers, and all of those things were not teaching me, because I grew up in a very spiritual community. My grandfather was an Episcopal priest, and we would have endless discussions where I would challenge him on the various things in the Bible. And I just decided that I needed to learn more about this thing called God. And eventually I joined an organization which was very instructive for me. It was a group called Eckankar, that's Eckankar. And what I later learned, because I eventually left that teaching because I found that it was the foundation of it was based upon a lot of misconceptions, individuals setting themselves up as just like a cult, like what Trump has done to the United States, where people believe whatever they say and they don't question it or look deeper. And I eventually decided that because I was a speaker for this organization, having moved up in the organization very quickly, I was doing most of it speaking. In other words, I was literally the only person who spoke in Africa, bringing that teaching to that country. I went to Europe, spread that spiritual teaching, and at least my version of it, to people in Germany and all of the different European countries, and developed a level of notoriety with that organization that I was able to travel around the world speaking before very large audiences in Canada, the United States, and as I said, in Europe and in Africa. So as I continued to do that, I eventually saw that there was a great deal of deception involved in this teaching, and I just couldn't abide the law, the lie. I took it on, and I eventually wrote a book that was called Confessions of a God Seeker, A Journey to Higher Consciousness. And what occurred to me and what was the basis of this foundation was that there are higher truths and more fundamental truths about our nature. Having studied the Bible and of course, read it more as I began my spiritual search, I captured most of what I learned and eventually decided to set up my own organization, not built around me, the person, but built around these great truths that one would learn if one chose or decided to take a path to higher consciousness. And so I set up an organization called the Higher Consciousness Society and Movement, in which I dedicated myself to bringing these great truths that I had learned of a much higher spiritual principle than was contained even in the Bible, but transcended it. And I would teach people as a seeker and one who taught these different courses and classes, most of the teaching of which, or at least some of the teaching of which, is contained in my book. But, of course, I have continued to grow and move even further along in my understanding. And what I try now to teach people is to get them to understand that planted within you is an aspect of God itself. That is one of the fundamental aspects of this teaching that one learns as one seeks to learn more about the higher consciousness. And while there are great masters that continue to teach these things to us, such as Master Jesus. All of these great teachers, Buddha, Jesus, people like Serapis Bey, El Morya, Kuthumi, these great names, some of which people may know, some that they don't. But what one learns is that the great path that we all have to take is to come eventually to the recognition that God dwells within us and that we are one with God. And when we understand that, it's not an ego trip. It's to understand the great power that we are vested with to bring these great truths to the world. And that is one of the activities that I am most strongly involved in as a writer and as a teacher. And a great deal of this information is taught, the foundations of it are taught in my book. First of all, some of the things I learned from earlier teachings that were not good and that would get you off on the wrong path. And anybody that's running a cult, or, and indeed some religions take on the aura of a cult where the leader of the church or the leader of that person becomes the individual that all try to look up to and worship, and that is not the purpose or what we call the great work or the divine plan. I term this in my book the great work, and also it is part of the divine plan. God has a divine plan for each of us and for this planet. And the closer we get and people get to understanding what that divine plan is and what it means for each of us, we begin to expand and explore our own great powers that lie within us. For example, we are all creators, and we are given the power to create. We are given that power by the power of thinking, the power of visualization, and the power of emotion. Those are the three ingredients that make up the great power of creation, that whether we realize it or not is what all of us utilize in bringing about any result that we want to see occur in our lives, and becoming a truth seeker of the truth, which is what the higher consciousness society is about. One learns about these great steps. One learns about the power of spirit. And one learns about the true meaning and understanding of God, the creator of the universe, and how it was able to utilize these great beings that they invested the power of creation with. And those beings include us. We are the ones that have been created and brought into existence for the purpose of utilizing the great powers that God has invested within us. And I have utilized these powers every day. I teach classes three times a week. One called decree sessions. A decree is another form of prayer, only it's more powerful. A decree is based upon the fundamental premise that God dwells within me. And just as Jesus, who saw this great God that he came to recognize as his Father, he also teaches and taught that these things dwell within us. That is why he made the statement, deeds greater than these ye shall do. But he was first of all acknowledging that all of the things that I have done, you too can do. And that is the foundation of the real role and the real search of the seeker. It is to learn that great truth and to understand what does it mean when one says that God dwells within me and I am a creator, as God is a creator, and I have been given the powers of creation. Indeed, the realization of the divine plan that God has sent for all of us, which is for each and every one of us to follow the example of the Master Jesus, who was able to ascend, reach the ascension in his lifetime. We all have the capacity to ascend, and the higher consciousness society teaches individuals what they need to do, what they need to learn, and the practices they need to follow in order to achieve the ascension in this lifetime, where all of these great masters like Buddha and Jesus become our brothers and our sisters as servants of God, because we have been given this great gift, but most people don't realize the gift that we have and don't know how to use that gift. It starts with a decision that we make to decide something that we want in our lives, some aspect of ourselves that we want to change, or a house, a car, whatever it is. I have taught these principles all around the world, and people have been very fortunate to be able to bring into their lives and into their world whatever it is they want, but they have to understand how to do it. The first thing is to decide what it is, what do you really want? And you may want an object, you may want a change in yourself, you may want to develop a set of habits and a set of approaches in your life that you have not yet as built into your life stream as habits that are more desirable, or you may want to get rid of some habits. You may want companionship or a mate. All of these are things that are very possible for you to create and bring into your life yourself, because you have the great power that is imbued in all of us as a creator and as a child of God. This aspect of being a child of God, just as Jesus, just as Buddha, just as Kuthumi, just as El Moya, these are all great names that you come in contact with and are able to call into your own existence through the process of decrees. You see, prayers are when you're asking for something. You want someone to bring you something or give you something. That's okay, and you certainly can seek this assistance, and it can happen to you. But a prayer is not nearly as powerful as a decree, because a decree starts from a different premise. A prayer starts from the premise that there is God and there are beings that you can pray to. We see pictures of them in church windows, and we call them by the names of saints and other high names. Their names are shown in the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all great beings that you can call upon for their help, because all of them have reached the level of the ascension, the first step in a seeker's journey to higher consciousness. And I have, at this point in my own development, have tended to turn my life now over to being a perpetual seeker and teaching others how to develop, utilize, and explore the great powers that you come with. It's just that you may not know how to use them. And so you start by deciding what you want in yourself, in your financial life, in your in the relationship that you have with helping other people and teaching other people, in the material aspects of your life, and of course in the physical aspects, your own health and the things that you want to bring about in your own health, that you may live longer and become and be able to devote more and more of your time to this task of learning and discovering who and what you really are as a creation of this universal creator, this thing that we call God. In the teaching that I work with now and laid the foundation for, and only as a teacher, I teach these different classes. And one session is called a decree session. The difference in a decree session and simply a prayer session is a decree works from the premise that God created me, and I have been created with an aspect of itself within me, within my own heart structure. I have been invested with a threefold flame, a flame from God itself, whom we call the universal creator, the first source and center of all creation, the first source and center, a term that we use instead of God itself, because as we learn to identify with the fact that this creator, this first source and center lies within me, and that I can utilize this great power that is vested in me to manifest anything that I wish to bring into my life, whether it is of a material nature, a spiritual nature, a personal nature, a companionship nature, or to learn more about God, which is what those who listen to the talks that I give on a weekly basis, who call in and are able to ask questions and participate in these sessions, which are conducted utilizing freeconferencecall.com, which enables people to call in. It doesn't cost them anything, and they get to to listen to these great discourses that we play on tape, in tape fashion, that were presented by these great masters. For example, one of the books that I always recommend to people that's part of what's called the Saint Germain series. Saint Germain was one of these great beings who, as Jesus, understood how to work with the Father, the power of the Father that dwelled within him, and bring many of these great teachings into the world. And he has a series of volumes that's part of the Saint Germain, G-E-R-M-A-I-N-E, Saint Germain, S-T, Saint Germain series. And he has 20 volumes. He has an entire volume that's dictated by Jesus. And so you can learn the even higher teachings that he brought forth, far greater than and far exceeding even what he was able to leave behind in the New Testament, which represent the rememberings of his disciples that he taught at that time. But he continued his teaching in volume 17 of the Saint Germain series. If you go into Amazon and you type in Saint Germain series, you'll see a listing of all 20 of the volumes in that series. And that series is one of the foundational teachings that we utilize in the Higher Consciousness Society movement, because it lays forth these great truths that were set forth by great masters who all achieved the same ascension of becoming a master working in the implementation of the divine plan. But there is one other book that I would have to recommend to you, and some of you may know about it, but it is also one of the books that expands the paradigm. A paradigm is a set of beliefs and understandings that you have about how you operate and how the universe works, and it's on the basis of this paradigm. In other words, it's a set of your beliefs, things that you really do believe yourself, and the higher this paradigm aligns itself with these great teachings that I'm now talking to you about, the more you will be able to bring into your own lives the very things that you want to see happen. I have manifested houses, cars, mansions, whatever, companies. I used to run my own company called the Koba Institute, and that's K-O-B-A Institute, .org is my website for that. But we also have a website for the Higher Consciousness Society, and it is www.higherconsciousnesssociety.org, and there you can find many of the discourses that we have that were put forth by these great beings, all of whom achieved the ascension in the same manner that Jesus did, and whose have as a major assignment and task set for them by this first source and center, the God of the universe, the Creator, working through its many, many varied levels of creation, the archangels, the Elohim, those beings that have the power and mastered the power of utilizing the fire of God and the rays of God to bring into their own lives or the lives of others who call on them for their assistance and help, or individuals who decide to teach themselves how to utilize these same powers. You also will learn how to use the sacred fire of God. You will learn how to use the great rays of God based upon the colors that align themselves with the great attributes of the Creator, the first source and center that you begin to integrate in your own life. And these are the things that are taught in this path to higher consciousness. They are the things that represent the truths that have been set forth by these great beings, these masters who all worked with the first source and center, what we call God. They worked with this being, and they all achieved the ascension where one becomes a master in the use of all of these great powers. That is what one becomes, or one is in the direction of becoming, where you too become a teacher of these great truths and learn how to utilize them in manifesting in your own life whatever you choose to bring yourself into a state of perfection and a state of purity, which is the pathway and the goal of those who seek the paths of higher consciousness. And that is what my role and my journey has become, this journey to higher consciousness. It is to achieve the ascension in this lifetime, which is my first goal and objective. And the other is to know how to utilize this great sacred fire, which whose fundamental power is the power of love. And in understanding the power of love, which is reflected in the rays of light and bringing more light into my own heart and into my own causal body, which represents the store of energy that I can call upon in order to issue a decree. And the decree comes into reality in the same way that Jesus' call for miracles were able to come into existence immediately. Whatever those miracles were, he would call on his Father, and he would call on his Father by virtue of the I Am presence, which is what we call this presence of God that dwells within the hearts in each and every person. And that I Am presence, the presence of God, dwells within you, and it utilizes the same name for identification as you do when you say, I am this or I am that, or I feel this way or I feel that way. One has to be very careful about the use of the word I and also the word am, because when asked by Moses, by what name do we call thee, the answer is, I am that I am. And so that has become, by virtue of the teachings of these great masters, all of whom achieved the ascension, as well as Jesus who achieved the ascension, utilize the term I am, and because they know that the I Am presence dwells within them. And when you call upon this I Am presence to make any change in your life that you want, you are making a decree, because a decree flows from someone who has the power of creation vested within them, excuse me, by the great universal Father, the great creator of all things, who has vested this great fire, the fire of God, the sacred fire, within the heart centers of each and every one of us. And by virtue of vesting that power within us, we have the power of manifestation. I can only tell you that I have utilized it and manifested the things that I have sought in life and still work with it every single day. I do these exercises in which I'm able to bring more and more of this power of the light of God, into my heart center, and it affects my causal body. If you have studied any of the occult teachings, you will know that you also have an occult, you also have a causal body, and that causal body is not only the record of and deposit of all the things that you have brought into your life that you have done of a positive nature, which has brought this energy into your own causal body as storage of light energy and causal light, that is to say the great love of God within you, which gives you the power of manifestation. And each of the colors that flow as rays of light from the sacred fire, light that flows from the great central sun magnet. There is a central sun, and the creator, this first source and center, which is the true God power, that physically is located on this planet, rather the sun that we call Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S. But if you get the Urantia book, you will learn more and more about these great secrets. They're only secrets to those who don't know about where these great truths are contained. And this pathway to find them is really what my own life mission is about. It's about teaching more and more people how to learn about the great power of creation that lies within each and every one of us. And if you want to know the true power of these words, just say to yourself, I am, I am, I am. And when you declare that, you are saying that this presence of God dwells within me. So by declaring I am, what you are saying is that I accept that God dwells within me. And it cannot dwell within you unless you accept it as such, because it is the recognition and acceptance of whatever it is that you are trying to bring into manifestation, which is step one. First step is decide what you want. The second step, as you progress along this path to higher consciousness, you learn how to utilize the great power of saying I am, because when you are calling on I am, you are invoking the I am presence that dwells within you. You have to first accept the reality that you are a creation of God, and this creation has placed an aspect of itself within each of the entities and beings that it has created. And so as you become a seeker to learn more about this reality, which I can very much recommend that you, if you take a look at the book that I have put forth called Confessions of a God Seeker by Ford Johnson, A Path to Higher Consciousness, this book is available on Amazon. Much of the original stock that we place with Amazon, they are sold out on. But if you find that the only version of it that may be available is the Kindle version, Kindles are not very expensive at all. You can get them for $39, $40, $45. I don't make any from that, so don't. That's not why I'm telling you about it. I'm just telling you sometimes to get the Kindle. You can read the Kindle itself, and you can also listen to it. It has a playback capability. And the Confessions of a God Seeker is a pretty long book. It's got all kinds of content, and you may find it very beneficial to read the book and listen to it. And if you do that, you will be able to gain so much of what I have been instructed and taught in how to write, because I was very much guided by this inner direction to write this book. So it contains many of these great spiritual secrets and some of the great powers that were invested in me to be a teacher and to be one to guide people to these great teachings so that they can continue to expand their own lives. As you read this book and all of the other books that from time to time I will tell you about, you will be able to understand what you have to do. And there are various exercises and various papers that I send out twice a week to any individual who registers to become a member of the Higher Consciousness Society /movement. You will receive these papers by email so that you can download them, and we will try to make available to you all of the papers that we put forth. And these sometimes are 10, 11, 12, 13. Some of our larger papers may run up to 15 or 16 pages, but most of them are within the below 20 range. But they are the teachings of this great universal creator, the first source and center. And these are the teachings that are put forth by great masters like Jesus, like Buddha, like even Muhammad achieved the ascension through this same process. And so whether you're a Christian, whatever your spiritual teaching or following may be, there is more to learn. And the first thing to learn is that God truly dwells within you, this I am presence. And all you have to do to build it and grow it is to send love to it, accept the reality of its existence within you, and accept the fact that you have this power, and you develop more and more of this power as you send love to these great masters, Master Jesus, Master Buddha, Sanat Kimura. There are so many. But as you read about, if you go to our website, www.higherconsciousnesssociety.org, if you look at the cover page and you go down, you'll see on the left-hand side a small blank application that you can fill out. And once you fill that out, you will be on our mailing list. So every 2 weeks when we send out a mailing, you will receive the mailing. So your understanding of these great principles, you will be able to continue to learn. I'll make sure to leave these emails with Lee, and so he'll be able to. Some of them will be on perhaps his website or This information is found on the website of the Higher Consciousness Society.org. So that is something about my role as a seeker. It is the predominant role that I now play. Because of my power to issue decrees, I am able to issue a decree that can influence the Senate of the United States, that can influence the House of Representatives of the United States. And the more people do this, and we will give you decrees that you can utilize, because once you recognize and you utilize the great I Am power, when you say and send love to the I Am presence or to the Sirius source, which is the source of the light power that flows from God, first source and center, the eternal sun is what the individual becomes. You become one of your seven bodies, and there's one paper we send out called the seven-body system. But you will have the ability to call in and listen to the many, many discourses that these great masters dictate and bring into the presence and availability of people in the physical state. And that is one of the principal ways in which this great divine truth and the great divine plan is implemented in the physical plane by people such as yourself, as you're listening, to begin to learn these great principles and to share it with other people that you feel are candidates for expanding a higher state of consciousness. But you'll know who they are because you talk to them. If you are listening and learning, you are also an individual of a higher consciousness. And all I am about is guiding the individual to reach higher and higher states of consciousness, which is really what our journey to the physical earth, as we take reincarnated states, you know, you live over and over again because of reincarnation. But how many people truly understand this and are able to work with one of these great spiritual truths? Well, we have papers that we send out that will teach you all about these things. So I encourage you to go to the Higher Consciousness Society.org and stay on the cover page, but go over to the left and you'll see the space you have to fill in and click it, and it will send your name and it'll immediately go on the mailing list where you'll receive some of these fundamental papers, foundational papers that represent this path to higher consciousness. So I think I'd like to pause at this note. If you have any questions, I would prefer that if you get some of the materials that we're sending, and if you get the book and you read it, you'll be able to understand what this is about. So you can also go to Amazon.com, and you can put in Confessions of a God Seeker, the path to higher, a journey to higher consciousness. If you type that into Amazon, it'll take you to the site, and you'll be able to see some of the foundational information that will enable you to begin this journey, at least from the point at which I have begun my own exercise as I consider myself a guide. I am constantly learning and being guided. In fact, I was guided by these inner flows of journeys to me by these great masters teaching me what to write in these various chapters so that I would be able to lay a foundation that people would be able to use to move even higher in their understanding. And it definitely transcends the great truths that beings, ascended masters like Jesus, were able to bring forth to the world through the teachings contained in the New Testament. But these contain many of those great truths, and there are many contained there. But that's not the end of it. That's just the beginning of it. But the objective of all of our journeys into this physical dimension through our constant reincarnations, rebirths and deaths and whatnot, is to learn more and more and more, as many lifetimes as it takes, to be able to become a true servant and being, as a master, as an ascended being, in order to help implement this great divine plan that exists for each and every one of us. And it becomes our mission, my mission now, and the mission of anyone who decides to align themselves with these higher states of consciousness, to help others gain the same truth that you have or will learn if you gain the book and gain some of these new, some of these fundamental papers that we will send to you that will lay an even stronger foundation of understandings of what these various teachings set forth by these beings that have reached the level of ascension and beyond. Many of them are cosmic beings, but these are all things and terminology that one learns as they seek some of these great teachings that we are setting forth in my book and in these other materials that we send to everyone that wishes to learn more about it. All right, I'm going to stop here, and I mean, there are so many things that one could ask.
Let's take the next caller. Caller 6057. Your question or comment? Caller 6057. Welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you. Let's see. I've learned a lot from you. I want to ask you. You had mentioned earlier that you met Malcolm X while he was on his Hajj.
Yes.
What did you? What was the thing that you? What was the biggest influence you learned as a result of meeting with him?
Well, I think the greatest impression I got and what I learned from him in terms of what he said to us was that he was beginning to understand that the role that he had played as the principal spokesperson for Elijah Muhammad was one in which that teaching was moving people in the direction of separation and the achievement of the great goals that were potential in this country on their own, because the movement was about separation. The thing that struck me the most as I heard him and that I found, of course, embodied in the books that have come out with his, as an aspect of his teaching, is that he was beginning to believe that that truth was not locked up in little channels like blacks will do this and whites will do that. I mean, he saw that there was separation, but what he understood, because he talked about it, he said, I met many, many, many whites who were just as interested in learning more and more about themselves and about the great truth of God. Malcolm was a very spiritual being, very spiritually centered in what he knew, what he understood, and it appeared to me in his desire. And so it did flow a great deal away from the principal teaching that originally he was instructed to put forth by Elijah Muhammad, which was far more on the separation side and more about what we could do for ourselves economically and whatnot, which was still an aspect of a truth that he believed in, but he didn't believe that. He didn't appear to believe in the separation or setting up white people as devils or things of that nature, which he was blamed for and which was one of the things that in which he and Elijah Muhammad and how that was taught. So he still had great respect and love for Elijah Muhammad, but he knew that he was in a somewhat dangerous place because he knew that there were beings within that teaching that were very much devoted to the center core teaching of Elijah Muhammad, and would be inclined, if they felt that Malcolm had gone too far in the other direction and was a threat to Elijah, because there were many personal aspects about Elijah's life that eventually came out, and he was very much disliked by many in that teaching because he was seen as a threat to Elijah Muhammad, which was, I believe, and he always thought that could happen. And so he, in a sense, believed that was what was intended for him, and eventually it did happen. But I was very struck by how broad his thinking was, how ecumenical you could say that his teaching was. He saw around the world in people of many different races a capacity to love, a capacity to give. It became very different from, if you listen to some of his earlier speeches, as he was Malcolm X, the leader of the principal spokesperson for Elijah, it was very different, and his biography, I think, reflects more the new notions. And it actually, in his biography, it actually talks about the journey that he made to Africa and to Ghana, and he even talked about the meeting that he held with these Peace Corps volunteers. I was very interested to see that. Not that we made an impact on him, but he certainly made an impact on us. Okay.
In the response, caller.
I'm sorry?
Okay. No, I asked the caller, did he have anything else you want to ask or raise?
Yes, I did. Do you think that that is Africans' lack of permanent organization causes us to have to revisit certain battles like the struggle for the right to vote, for example, which it seems like there are various forces that are trying to take away after we worked for so hard to sustain that, to obtain that. And that is only one aspect of gaining political power, an important aspect, but not to be an end-all.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how much does our lack of permanent organization, do you think, contributes to those having to re-wage those battles every generation or so?
Well, I don't think it has a lot to do with Africa at this point. I think Africa has been more inspirational, but they are caught up in their same battles, trying to achieve even the ability to break away from their colonial masters, and that still carry a great deal of weight. In terms of their impact on America, it has been more a cultural empathy that we have developed, that they have developed for. When I was in Africa, the people were very kind to me and very happy to see me, almost regarding me as one of the long-lost brothers who had returned home. And I think my journey to Africa had a great deal of impact on me, but not in the same way as one might think. It didn't influence my work in America involved in the civil rights struggle, because the American civil rights struggle is defined by its environment, by the various party systems, by the history by our history here, and the history of other beings, white beings who want to stay in power. The things I was talking about earlier, that is a unique American struggle in its many ramifications and many tentacles. The African struggle is a similar struggle, but also a very different struggle. In many cases, Africa's struggle is against this autocratic tendency that we see, that we have seen grow in America, but it has been a part of Africa for some time. So many of the African leaders have become and are moving in the direction or have a tendency towards autocratic rule, because that is what they have observed when they look at the systems in England in particular. But they don't see that in America. They try to emulate the systems of democracy, but it's very hard for them because the foundational systems that Africans are accustomed to is the tribal system, where there's a chief. I mean, most tribal groups have grown up, and their whole structure is an autocratic structure. The chief is the one that rules, and others are members of the various royal houses, as they are called. I came to know many of the great tribal groups, and how I knew the chiefs directly, because they somehow would take on the aura of more power just because I was made a friend to their house, and because I came from America and I was a friend of the chief, somehow that granted to him more power. But it was all in the direction of the autocratic, more of the that type of power. I didn't see very much of the notion of democracy, although most of these African countries did follow the patterns of having the elections and having parties run against each other and to elect a head of the country. There was always, and even truly autocratic countries like China and even Russia, they go through the charade of an election, because there is something that's very public relations strong about the concept of having the people vote them in so that they're not just autocratic rulers. But I've seen as much of the tendency of autocracy in Africa as I've seen, at least the tendency in that direction. But there is also growing simultaneously a democratic set of feelings that they are devoting. But I don't think that the African issue and history and direction is as much influences us here in America. I think that the influence of the semblance of a democracy and voting, and every time we talk about it, we're always talking about voting here in America, that tends to be the idea or the concept that permeates many countries who always want to reflect that they are following the same example of an America, a democracy where people have the right to vote and decide on their leaders. That's a very popular notion which sells very well to the people and appears to be, just as it is here in America, the foundation on which autocracies are built. That's what Trump was trying to do and did a very good job of doing, and we'll see how far he can take it. But the lie and the tendency towards autocracy are two competing concepts that we see in Africa as well as in North America, and not so much in Canada as I think in America. I think America, with the four-year rule of Trump, took a bigger step in that direction than certainly Canada or any of the other countries that utilize the idea and the sounding and the feeling that the leaders are being voted in by the people. That's a much better sounding idea than "I am the boss, you do what I tell you to do, what laws I set down." So I don't see that those two, that the separation between Africa and its issues and problems and that of America, I don't think they come together that often, except the influence that they each have on each other. Certainly, as Africa has had a great influence on the African American population, and I think has strengthened the Democratic Party to a great degree, because it has gotten that voting bloc very much believing that Democrats really do have a greater belief in democracy, and that they can achieve a higher level of their own rights through voting with a Democratic, in support of the Democratic Party and its candidates than the Republican parties. But there are those that, even within the African American and the colored community from various immigrants from various other countries, some of them very much like the approach of a Trump. They like the autocratic approach. And so there will be, in time, that same division will continue and permeate here in this country. But I don't think in general that there is that much of a connection, except in very broad terms of how people see and what their reaction to are the people. Most people thought, and they certainly thought it in Africa, when Obama was in power, I mean, they thought for sure that, you know, he was the guy that would change everything and that he would exercise powers that would have an influence in Africa. But that did not happen. In fact, I think Obama was criticized more by his tendency not to be as autocratic, just as Biden is having that same problem. I think he's getting more criticism because he won't act with the power that everyone says he has. And I think that the exercise of that power would look a little more autocratic than what he has exhibited so far. But that has never been the approach or the strength, quite frankly, of the appeal of the Democratic Party as the Republican Party. Historically, the Republican Party has been moving down that track where they're prepared to utilize anything that separates people and therefore creates a foundation for autocracy than the Democrats have. So I see in very broad terms how those factors that we see here have also had similar influences in Africa, but not to the same degree.
Okay, let's move to our next caller. We can bring Brother Alex. Brother Alex, your comment or question, please.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Lee, for bringing Mr. Johnson on. And like our callers have said, we've learned an awful lot today. We've covered a lot of ground in a lot of areas, and I can't wait to read even more about him and also some of the things he mentioned. I knew about the Black Codes being, you know, first started around 1865, 1866. So, and that was to disenfranchise blacks coming out of the Civil War. But we have to recognize and be real with ourselves to realize that this country started under colonialism system. And in doing so, the power of the rich is what Washington and Jefferson, Madison, and quite a few others believed in. And Franklin and Hamilton and a few others, they believed in more of an equal system of justice, voting, rights for all citizens. But it came to point that only the privileged, white, wealthy landowners could vote. And in doing so, that discriminated against the women, the Indians, the blacks, and indentured servants, and all the poor whites in this country. So when we look back and say, how was America, and telling a truthful story, that was not wrong. That was wrong. That was not right. And many years ago, when Mississippi finally ratified the Constitution, one of the main things that clerk uncovered is the same thing I uncover a lot when I'm looking over covenants, real estate covenants, when people leave property behind. And yeah, one of those things, like saying that said premises shall not be rented, leased, or conveyed to or occupied by any other person than a white or Caucasian person. And this was, you know, accepted as law, a tradition, that you didn't have to have blacks in community, that they had to be on their side of town. They had to have their own businesses or whatever. They couldn't trade. They couldn't sit and eat with you and different things. So it was that idea that was built up over time. Even Oregon itself, when we go out west, has a population now less than 3%. And at one time, the state of Oregon, they had went further than anybody else, and they excluded blacks from entering the state. They also excluded them from owning property within it. You couldn't buy property in Oregon. You couldn't enter the state. And so the school integration didn't come about in Oregon until the mid-1970s, after all that protesting and all out there and finding how bad Oregon really was. But you got other states like Montana and Idaho and a bunch of others, Wisconsin and Minnesota. I mean, they were just as bad and had terrible laws also. So as long as it was known or thought as an institution that this is the way America should be, from that simple thought of colonialism, that we can take over property and people's minds and lives and do it as we please with them because they are not the white Europeans that had came here. So it's that big indifference that they see when they see people of color, an American Indian or Mexicans or Haitians or whatever. You're different from them. And they see a power privilege because they've been known as kings and queens and had different wars with each other for so many years, and with ships and boats and cannons and guns, all the weaponry, they figured they could do basically whatever they could over any nation with bows and arrows and spears and lances. So with that thought in mind, going back to, and I really do appreciate what you're doing to work on our voting rights, because I'm so afraid that even if it did pass, and it's a shame that on the Republican Senate side that we can't get that one vote that's even on that side. And that's just shameful to not be able to get that one single vote for George Floyd or for the John Lewis bill. So
yes.
When you can't even get convinced certain people that this is the right thing to do, when it gets to the Supreme Court, even if it does pass, like most legislation, and the last legislation, Mr. Johnson, that happened with you, you went through a great time because I think Thurgood Marshall was sitting on the court. And you had a few other people that were good judges and had good judgment and saw America changing and being the true country that it was being talked about for so many years. But now if we look at the Supreme Court, it seems like they're trying to either circumstance Roe versus Wade and a few other things and look the other way. Will they do that? If, say, the John Lewis voting rights bill is passed, the George Floyd bill is passed, and someone puts up a challenge to, will the law of the land that these gentlemen have sworn oath to protect, and we know about people who have sworn an oath and have not carried through with it. So do you think in this perilous time that a case like yours that may come back through again, but say for voting rights or say for police brutality against a citizen or something, if it hits the Supreme Court, with the court that we have sitting today, do you think it would be a just decision just in your case, or would it be one that will be make America shame again? And I appreciate your comment.
Yeah.
And before you comment, Mr. Johnson, before you comment, I'm asking you to try to respond within 3 minutes. Okay? The mic is yours.
Okay. I would say that I believe that it actually would have a chance of being supported, and I say that first of all because of the fact that it would have been passed by a vote. It would be a law of the country because it would have been passed by the House and by the Senate, and a law, in a sense, a passed law, does not give them the latitude to even react to it in the same way that they were able to react to my case, because my case was not their acting on a law that had been passed, except to the extent that the state Supreme Court had supported the decision of the lower court that had set the contempt charge in the first place. But it was not as difficult for them to override a state Supreme Court. But when they're looking at a law that has been passed and has gone through the entire process, they know that the limitation of what they can do is to interpret what was the intent of the Congress, not their own reading of it or what they think should be, but what was intended by the legislators who set this law forth. Now, what has held that up is that they have not been able to finish writing the darn thing because they've been making changes within it, first to combine the two laws that the two different provisions that had originally been passed by the House. They had to collapse that into, I think they've been trying to collapse it into a single act or provision, and that's taken some time because it takes very careful wording to do that. But given the power that it's coming over as a full act, an act of Congress with the big C, both party, both houses, there I think that there's a much greater chance in trying to interpret the intent that they had in passing this is very clear. It is to eliminate any discrimination that might exist purely at a state level. That's why I think my earlier comment that this battle to a great degree is being held at the state level, because that's where the power to set all these different laws that eventually get to the Supreme Court, whether, even if they don't make it. And that's why they were trying to move it and to get the Congress to pass a law, which is more difficult for the Supreme Court to overturn if it's passed by Congress rather than coming up through the state court system. But I think that if these laws, this combined law, these two laws, or the filibuster can be brought into some shape that it should reasonably be and not have the power that it had in the earlier days where they could literally they use it to stop and delay any kind of civil rights or truly constitutionally significant law. It took a while to get those things through, the challenges that would be placed, and they would use filibustering to do it. So whether or not Biden feels that he can take those stronger steps of pushing more for either going, you know, doing the same thing that, I don't know, there's various steps. There's a number, I was listening to a number of sites that were talking about the power that Biden still has and what he can do if he decides to be just a little bit more autocratic in exercising the powers that vest in the president, that he would have the ability potentially to get something to happen on these voting rights bills that I think are the most important things that are in front of this country. But as to, for example, your earlier comment that that these blue laws and black codes were from the very early age, this particular book that I'm talking about was published back in 2004, and it actually brings it up to date, brings a lot of that up to date. It's really a book well worth looking at if you want to get into more of the legal aspects of it and the history. Interestingly, there was a case that, I think I'm on my 3 minutes here, so let me stop there.
Thank you. And our last caller and comment for today's program, we can go to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, your comment or question, please.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm just very elated that I was on with my brother, and I am sure our awareness has been expanded by the authentic words that he's giving you today. And this recording is so important that we need to revisit it many times because so much information has been given. And we have a way, there's a way out of this madness of voting oppression. And he's given it to us. Now, we've got to get some lawyers that have national recognition to take this and go forward with it. And me being a freedom fighter also, I'm just so excited about knowing this. I learned a lot about the case today that I didn't know before. And I'm his older sister, so what can I say? It's been great. Thank you, Lee, for having him. And thank you, Ford, for doing a great job. Back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, this is MPH Radio. We'd like to inform our listening audience this radio program is under the direction of Missing Pages of History. It's a bi-weekly program. Comes on every other Saturday. Our next program will be October the 16th at 1 p.m. So share the word, spread the word, and come and join us. What we're going to do right now, we're going to give Mr. Johnson, as a freedom fighter, as a traveler, and as a seeker, we're going to give him 2 minutes to make some final remarks. At any of the remarks, Mr. Johnson, I hope you can articulate how people can get in contact with you. If they would like to have you come to their schools, their communities, et cetera, to talk about the history that you have made to our people as relates to the whole question of this litigation around Johnson versus Virginia, as well as you being one of the freedom fighters under the banner of Richmond 34. So we can give you a final thoughts, and then we'll come back and make ours. So the mic is yours, Mr. Johnson. 2 to 3 minutes, your final thoughts.
Okay, well, I think that in 2 minutes, the thing I would like to convey is, again, the information. If you have a pen, you can jot some of this down. I'll give you some of these names and addresses, again, where you can follow through. I would, again, recommend, as you go to Amazon, the book Confessions of a God Seeker, a journey to higher consciousness will lay for you a very solid foundation of understanding where you can pursue even more the spiritual side, the seeker side of this. And with respect to the other book that I mentioned, Blue Laws and Black Codes, that is a book that was, as I say, written by Dr. Peter Wallerstein. I know him. We have shared the stage on a number of different occasions where we've gone through the history. And but I do think that I've been very impressed with the action of the MSNBC News individuals and how the various people on that program seem to be doing a very good job of laying out the full foundation of things. So I would encourage people, if you don't watch MSNBC, check them out, and I think you'll get a much fuller feel of this whole thing, especially with the background that's being provided by the Reverend, the minister that is one of the broadcasters on that channel.
And on that note, you listen to the voice of MPH Radio on the banner of Missing Pages of History. And our theme today was the freedom fighter, the traveler, and the seeker. Speaking with Mr. Floyd T. Johnson, Jr.
Ford,
Mr. Ford T. Johnson, Jr. He has given us his perspective on some of his experiences as it relates to the struggle by our people, as it relates to him being having the opportunity to travel around the world, as well as being a seeker of truth and the growth of spirituality. We'd like to thank him for coming in and helping us to fill in some of our missing pages of history. And we'd like to encourage you to make sure you take some time to look at this whole question of the contribution that he made as it relates to breaking down desegregation, and when we look under the different things that are happening in our law history, remember that Mr. Ford, you know, how he played a role as a young student, as a freedom fighter, to create conditions where we could desegregate these public stores and stuff. And you can see that under the case Johnson versus Virginia. So until the 16th on Missing Pages of History, we'd like to just remind you that we'll be on every other Saturday. We need your support. One of the ways you can support us is to email us and become a member and a supporter of MPH Radio by emailing us at mphradio@yahoo.com. And, of course, if you want to send in blessings, contributions, you can send that to Missing Pages of History, P.O. Box 27782. Richmond, Virginia, 23261. So until next time, we conscribe to go forward wherever and backwards never. And we are here for all of us. We are one community. We must strive to fight as one. And when we talk about fight as one and some of the concept of freedom, let me just go back as I begin the program, remind you on some of the concept of freedom as it relates to our forefathers. To give you something to think about. We said from Frederick Douglass, he stated, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. From Dr. Martin Luther King, he stated freedom in the context of the time is always right to do what's right. That's right. The time is always right to do what's right. And last night, at least, we look at our civil rights activist, A. Philip Randolph, where he stated, freedom is never given. It is won. That's right. No one can give you freedom. You must take it. So on that note, we will see you on the 16th. And come and join us and help us build Missing Pages of History. We see you on the 16th of October.
here, we are here. Bombs over Baghdad, trying to get something we never had. Let's start with a good dad. So real, but it's so sad. And while we burning this incense, we gon' pray for the innocent. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about Chi-Town. Let's talk about Gaza. Let's talk about Israel. Right now with Israel. Let's talk Nigeria. In the mass hysteria. Yeah, our souls are brought together so that we could love each other, brother. We save the nation with no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about living. Had enough of dying. That's what we all about. Let's do more giving. Do more forgiving. Yeah. Our souls were brought together so that we could love each other. Sister, we
while we are here.